It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. President Obama reassures nervous Gulf partners. President Barack Obama says the United States has an ironclad commitment to the security of its Gulf allies and would consider using military force if they were threatened. Mr. Obama hosted a summit of leaders and senior ministers from the Six Nation Gulf Cooperation Council at the Camp David Presidential Retreat north of Washington Thursday.
As we've declared in our joint statement, the United States is prepared to work jointly with GCC member states to deter and confront an external threat to any GCC state's territorial integrity that is inconsistent with the UN Charter.
The Gulf leaders came to the summit looking for reassurances from the president that the U.S. is fully committed to their security. The U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill giving Congress the right to approve or reject a nuclear deal with Iran. Thursday's vote was 400 to 25. The Senate passed the measure last week. The White House says President Obama now plans to sign it. The bill gives Congress 30 days to review a nuclear deal among Iran, the U.S., and five other major world powers. During those 30 days, Mr. Obama will be barred from waiving any U.S. sanctions against Iran. Burundi's presidential office says President Pierre Nkurunziza is back in the country, saying that a military coup attempted while he was in Tanzania failed. Mr. Nkurunziza's office says security forces are looking for the coup leaders so they can be brought to justice. There's been no independent verification of the president's return to Burundi. Rival army factions were still battling for control of the capital, Bujumbura, on Thursday. The fighting was centered around the state radio and TV complex. This is VOA News. The northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri is under an army-imposed dusk-to-dawn curfew after suspected Boko Haram militants attacked the Borno state capital. Witnesses say hundreds of militants carried out the assault Wednesday with guns and heavy explosives. There were also reports that several suicide bombers were among the attackers. Soldiers repelled the assault after several hours of fighting. The French news agency reports at least three Nigerian soldiers, six vigilante fighters, and dozens of Boko Haram fighters were killed. The Islamic State group released an audio message, it says, is from its leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who has not been seen or heard from in months. The message urges Muslims to take up arms in its cause and emigrate to the caliphate it's proclaimed in areas of Syria and Iraq. Western news agencies have not been able to verify whether the voice was al-Baghdadi's. Despite a ceasefire in Yemen, the fighting continues. Ed Duranian has details.
News media Thursday reported Houthi rebel militiamen fired tank shells and rockets at Sunni tribal fighters in Yemen's third largest city of Taiz overnight, in one of several reported violations of a humanitarian ceasefire. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that Houthi militiamen also shelled their opponents in the port city of Aden, in Dala, in Lauder, and in Marib. The Houthis Al Masira TV said that Saudi planes bombed a market in Hodeida and a civilian vehicle in northern Saada province. VOA could not independently verify the claims. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
The Taliban claimed responsibility for an hours-long attack on a guest house in Kabul, the Afghan capital. They killed 14 civilians, including several foreigners. The attack began Wednesday night when gunmen began shooting at the Park Palace Hotel during a party for foreigners. 5 hours later, it ended with police killing three assailants. The U.S. Embassy says one American was among the dead, while Indian officials say four Indians were killed. The Taliban claims the militants targeted the party because of the presence of Americans. President Obama thanked first responders and others who helped victims of Tuesday's Amtrak train accident in Philadelphia. The president also conveyed his deepest condolences to the families of the victims. Another body was pulled from the wreckage Thursday, pushing the death toll to at least eight, with another 200 injured, some of them critically. Investigators are trying to determine why the train was traveling at more than twice the posted speed limit before it crashed, but the lawyer for the train's engineer said Thursday he suffered a concussion in the accident and cannot recall what happened. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington. Today is Friday, May 15th, sitting in for the vacationing James Batty. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union says it will not accept any military takeover of a government.
The African Union has called for peace, but has, however, condemned the attempted military takeover because it's unconstitutional and it's against our democratic principles.
That was Aisha Laraba Abdullahi, the African Union's Commissioner for Political Affairs. Also, U.S. and Cameroonian officials work to eliminate visa fraud. A United Nations report looks into massacres in Beni territory in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
DRC Information Minister Lambert Mende condemned the atrocities. He told VOA the ADF had been totally indiscriminate, killing many women and children and often hacking their victims to pieces.
Reporter Nick Long has this reaction to the massacres in eastern DRC. The United States condemns the latest surge in fighting in South Sudan, and in Zimbabwe, continued strikes at some public and private companies mean workers are not earning a paycheck. Those stories plus Mark Omer's sport and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A high-ranking African Union official says the AU will not accept or recognize any military regime that comes to power through unconstitutional means. The AU's Commissioner for Political Affairs, Aisha Laraba Abdullahi, called for calm as the continental body works with regional leaders from the East African Community, or EAC, to help solve the political crisis in Burundi. Last week, the AU sent a delegation led by former Togolese Prime Minister Edem Kodjo to evaluate the situation on the ground. The visit came several days before General Godefroy Niyombare announced he had ousted Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza. Madam Abdullahi told me that the AU supports effort of the regional bloc to help resolve the crisis in Burundi.
The African Union has called for peace, but has, however, condemned the attempted military takeover because it's unconstitutional and it's against our democratic principles.
The high-powered delegation led by the former Prime Minister of Togo, Edem Kodjo, led a delegation to Burundi. What is the feedback that you've gotten so far following the ongoing clashes?
Okay, when His Excellency Edem Kodjo left for Burundi, along with Professor Ibrahim Afal, the mission at that time was to ensure that peace and calm is returned and to call on all parties to behave and ensure peaceful democratic transition in the country as we prepare for the elections. And then suddenly yesterday, when the East African Community was meeting and the chairperson of the commission was attending the meeting, then the attempted coup started, and we are following the issue closely.
I know the African Union is consulting at the moment to decide its next line of action, but what are the possibilities of considerations, especially looking at the fact that there is ongoing fighting between armed personnel in the country?
Well, the African Union is supporting the efforts of the East African Community. As you know, our regional economic communities are our building blocks. And when issues like this arise, we work together with the regional economic community, in this time the East African Community. And the leaders, of course, met yesterday. And I cannot preempt their stance, but from the communique of the meeting, it's very clear. We see that the Arusha Accord, which has provided the foundation for peace and power sharing in Burundi, we believe that it should be respected. And it clearly called for only two terms for a president, and this was made clear. But on the other hand, the position of the AU and the EAC is that the military coup should not be encouraged, and we should look for a constitutional arrangement in case there's need for any transition.
Some people have called for the AU's intervention. and for a military intervention to bring about the peace, and for the AU to lead the effort to organize snap elections and prevent incumbent President Nkurunziza from participating, since they accuse him of precipitating this unrest. What is your take on this call on the AU?
Well, I don't think there's any need for any snap election, because according to election calendar of Burundi, the parliamentary elections should be held this month, and then the presidential elections next month. However, considering the turmoil and the turbulence in the country, people leaving the country, over 50 refugees in the neighboring country of Rwanda, Tanzania, and DRC, we think that we are advising that the election calendar be reviewed and the elections be postponed. And we are calling for calm. And as long as the country is calm and peaceful, then we can have the polls this year. There's no need for any snap election, because this is the election year in Burundi.
Aisha Laraba Abdullahi is the African Union's Commissioner for Political Affairs. She spoke with me from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. The United Nations says Ugandan Islamist ADF rebels were mainly responsible for the summary executions of at least 237 civilians in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo between October and December last year. For VOA, Nick Long interviewed some survivors of those attacks and sent this report from Goma.
Since October, more than 300 people have been killed in a series of massacres in Beni territory in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Between October and January, UN investigators went on 13 missions to the area, visiting several massacre sites and speaking to 180 direct and indirect witnesses of the killings. On Wednesday, the head of the UN Human Rights Office in DRC, José María Aranas, gave reporters a brief summary of their findings.
La conclusion principale du rapport.
The main conclusion, he says, is that between October the 1st and December the 31st, summary executions of more than 230 people were carried out in a systematic, planned and premeditated way by the ADF. The report says the ADF was primarily responsible for the attacks. It says although the ADF leaders are Ugandan, most of the rank and file are Congolese, which would explain why many who saw the attackers said they spoke Congolese languages. The investigators also heard allegations that ordinary citizens and some authorities in Beni territory helped the ADF carry out the massacres with information and logistics.
Il faut aussi remarquer que moi il avait 300 personnes.
Aranas adds that at least 300 people were arrested by Congolese authorities in connection with the massacres, and at least 33 Congolese army soldiers were arrested as part of the fight against impunity. DRC Information Minister Lambert Mende condemned the atrocities. He told VOA the ADF had been totally indiscriminate, killing many women and children and often hacking their victims to pieces. He said the Congolese army is continuing intensive operations against the ADF, penetrating deep into the forest, where its special forces captured the terrorist headquarters and killed its number three leader on April the 20th. He confirmed the authorities have arrested many local people in Beni, including soldiers, some of whom have already been tried and convicted. He added that following the arrest of ADF leader Jamil Mukulu in Tanzania, the DRC government asked for Mukulu to be extradited to stand trial in Congo, as his crimes there are far worse than his crimes in Uganda. The UN report on the massacres only covers the period up to December the 31st. Since then, massacres have continued, although not on the same scale. VOA interviewed several civilians who survived the attacks, including a young man who was recovering from machete wounds to his head. He tells VOA he is sure the people who attacked them were ADF, because some of them were children and they spoke a language he could not understand. Another survivor at the hospital, Kambale Katinda, who was shot in the foot but managed to escape, explained why he thought the ADF were responsible. He was ambushed, he says. He looked up and saw he was surrounded by the enemy. They lined up and aimed their weapons at him, but several were only carrying machetes. Kambale added that if it were not for the Congolese army just a few hundred meters away, he would not have survived. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Thousands of Cameroonians apply to go to the United States each year for business, but many of them fall into the hands of people posing as middlemen for U.S. Embassy visa officials. United States Embassy officials have been working with Cameroon's judicial police to arrest and prosecute suspects and applicants who present fraudulent documents. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
Lillian Vetze is one among hundreds of Cameroonians asking for visas at the United States Embassy in Yaoundé early this week. She says it was the third time she was coming for an interview to travel to America.
I've been here several times. Each time I come, they ask me to present so many documents. They say I should bring marriage certificate, my academic certificate, bank statement. It's not been very easy. They ask me so many documents. I will go and come back after. They will still ask so many documents, and it's not been very easy.
Last Wednesday, Cameroon State Radio, CRTV, invited officials of the United States Embassy in Yaoundé to explain why there have been complaints that procedures to acquire visas are at times long and cumbersome. Consular official Nicholas Castellano says there are lots of fraudulent documents in a majority of the application files, and as such, they work with the Cameroon police to authenticate suspected documents.
A majority of Cameroonians' visa applicants come to the American Embassy with a fraudulent document. The most fraudulent types that we see are the introduction or business employment letters, financial statements, university transcripts. And so we've been able to partner with the judicial police and had numerous people in the last few months arrested. The judicial police do an investigation, take custody of the person, and then proceed them through the Cameroonian legal system.
Castellano says they have been able to turn many of the arrested suspects. He says it is both in their interest and that of the Cameroon government to have a fraud-free, fluid, and very easy process for everyone who has a legitimate application and good documents. Kweke Emmanuel of Cameroon's Judicial Police says there are well-established networks of visa frauds and middlemen claiming to represent U.S. Embassy staff in Cameroon. He says they even arrested a suspect who had obtained a fake police identification badge and always wore a police uniform before deceiving people that he could facilitate the process to establish visas at the United States Embassy. He says many of such suspects have been detained and are helping the police in their investigations. Roberto Quiroz, Public Affairs Officer of the United States Embassy in Cameroon, says they will continue the battle along with Cameroon's Judicial Police to clear the system of all fraudulent people whose goal is to extort money from visa applications. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Today is Friday, May 15. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Ahead on our program, Mark Omer Sports and our listener of the day. The United States is strongly condemning the latest surge in fighting in South Sudan and calling on the two sides in the long-running conflict to resolve their differences and prevent more loss of life. Charlton Doki spoke with U.S. Chargé d'Affaires in Juba, Michael McCarthy, and sent this report.
McCarthy says the U.S. government is deeply concerned by reports of heavy fighting in Unity and Upper Nile states. He says U.S. officials are working to determine who is responsible for reported human rights abuses committed during the recent surge in fighting.
What we're hearing are reports from dependable sources and multiple reports that corroborate each other of abuses being committed in this offensive into Unity State. We're not accusing anyone at this point. What we're saying is we need to shine a light to find out if these reports are true.
The United States early this week released a statement calling on the South Sudan government to allow what it calls protection actors to inspect sites where rights abuses are alleged to have occurred. U.S. officials say they have had reports of thousands of civilians being displaced by the latest violence. McCarthy says both sides in the conflict must allow humanitarian relief workers unhindered access to civilians affected by the fighting.
First, we need to silence the guns. Both sides have agreed so many times to cessations of hostilities. Both sides should put the people first and stop the fighting. That allows the humanitarian organizations and the protection workers to get into the area and do what they need to do to save lives and to work with the people.
The two sides in South Sudan's conflict signed a cessation of hostilities agreement in January last year. They have recommitted to it several times since then, but each time the fighting has continued unabated. The most recent clashes erupted in the two oil-producing states as President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar met in Addis Ababa for what was supposed to be the final round of talks to restore peace in South Sudan. The talks ended in early March without a deal. McCarthy says the latest uptick in violence in South Sudan is particularly troubling.
What especially concerns us this time, two things. Number one, these are horrific, horrific incidents on a very, very large scale in multiple sites. Number two, this just adds one more block to the road to unity and reconciliation, which is very discouraging at this time.
McCarthy says the U.S. government is working with the rest of the international community to ensure the warring parties end the fighting and return to the negotiating table. He says the United States also backs the creation of an impartial justice mechanism to ensure that people who committed the atrocities that have been reported throughout the conflict in South Sudan are held to account. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
In Zimbabwe, economic indicators are weak. Most private and public sector companies have been hit by crippling strikes, which have become the order of the day. Caught in the middle of all this are workers, many of whom are now working without expectation of a paycheck. Reporter Blessing Zulu spoke with prominent labor lawyer Rogers Matsikidze about what actions an unpaid worker can take.
Yeah, when a company fails to pay its workers, a worker can take that matter to the Minister of Labor. The matter goes through the normal processes of conciliation, arbitration, labor court. Then you get your award. You can register it with the High Court, execute the property, garnish the accounts. If those assets are there, but sometimes we've seen that some companies do not have those assets.
So when a company is liquidated, what's in for the worker there?
This is where our challenge is. Our workers here, they are actually suffering both ways, in the sense that when a company liquidates, the law does not make them what we call preferential or secured debtors. They are the least ones to be paid, so they get a zero. So we have seen that they want to go to the pensions. The pensions, there is nothing for them. The pensions are telling them between 2000 and now, your money actually is in dollarized. It was banned by inflation. So literally, we've got nothing. That is the reason why you are seeing in all urban centers, there are people who are educated, MBAs, busy senior people selling wares like your reticulars. They are selling sunglasses, vegetables, you know, and everything, because they've literally been reduced to vendors because of these issues.
Would you say Zimbabwe's labor laws are adequate or can actually protect the worker, or we are slowly going back to the draconian Master and Servant Act of 1991?
Yeah, we are having a very simple challenge, because now we have come to accept in Zimbabwe to say that a black worker is a black employer is not an accountable to anybody. Because the challenge which we have is lack of accountability. One is given a company today to run. The next morning, that company is empty. Where is the money? Where is it gone? Nobody even bothers. So we are having a problem. Those who are some of the people who are trying to say labor laws in Zimbabwe are actually not good for business. But the challenge which we are having is that the labor laws also in Zimbabwe, they are not good for employees on the sense that they don't protect the enterprise, the owners, from vouchering into the enterprise. In other words, taking assets outside.
That was Harare-based lawyer Rogers Matikizi speaking with reporter Blessing Zulu in Washington. It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Hosts Lesotho and South Africa play to a scoreless draw in a friendly in Maseru on Thursday. The two sides meet again tomorrow Saturday at the same venue. Elsewhere, Burkina Faso held their hosts Kazakhstan to a scoreless draw in Almaty. Elsewhere, Namibia play Seychelles as Zimbabwe engage Mauritius at the start of the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in Moruleng, Northwest Province in South Africa, on Sunday. Meanwhile, Ivory Coast's Francois Zahoui is the new coach of the Niger team, the Niger Football Federation disclosed in Niamey. Zahoui has been tasked to qualify Niger for the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. He guided Ivory Coast to finish second at the 2012 Nations Cup. Turning to rugby, South Africa challenge hosts England, then Canada and Russia at the Women's IRB 7 Series today, Friday. Staying in London, South Africa play Portugal, then France and the United States of America in their Group D preliminary in the Men's IRB Series tomorrow, Saturday. Kenya challenge hosts England, then Scotland and Brazil in their Group C preliminary. At the start of the final tournament in the nine-leg series, South Africa is second with 142 points in the series standings. Kenya is 13th with 38 points, while Zimbabwe is 20th with 1 point. In Portugal, Namibia face Tonga as they seek to get their campaign back on track at the Men's World Rugby Under-20 Trophy in Lisbon tomorrow, Saturday. Namibia earlier on lost to Canada 35-20 in their opening Group B encounter. Turning to athletics, the 2015 IAAF Diamond League gets underway in Doha, Qatar today, Friday. A second meet is scheduled for Shanghai, China on Sunday. Finally, the third edition of the Okpepe 10-kilometer road race will be contested in Edo State, South Nigeria tomorrow, Saturday. This is said to be the first road race to be run under an IAAF road running label in Africa. Okpepe was elevated to a bronze label status last October. The race has attracted elite long-distance runners from Cameroon, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Morocco, Uganda, and hosts Nigeria. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, Peter, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a wonderful day. Our listener mail for this Friday morning, May 15.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa and listeners across the world. You will permit me use this channel to congratulate the government and the team working people of Liberia and World Health Organization for finally wiping away Ebola virus in Liberia. Albert Alagbo from Akanebi and Federal Polytechnic, Ebonyi State, Nigeria. Thank you.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. That's it for this Friday, May 15 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Peter Clotte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a good Friday.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. And on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. That's Encounter on VOA.